when you get to the bake sales at primary school, but so when you have well, there'll be like a bake sale and you're supposed to bring cakes, and then you kind of through peer pressure end up having to run the bake sale sometimes, which is the longest hour of your life. But it always used to, and I never wanted to run the bake sale, and I always, and by the way, top tip, you buy a cake and bash it up a bit and put it in a tin, so you get, but don't go to Waitrose or somewhere where all the other parents from your middle class enclave will go. You've got to go somewhere like Iceland where no one will know what the cake look like, and then you bash it up, put it in a tip, and then
so put a bit of like kitchen paper on.
Definitely don't bring it in the wrapping paper. So that's first of all, but that takes time. You've got to go to the shop, bash it up, make sure you've got a cake tin. But then the people,
and then your kids come in and you're just like, Mum, why are you brandishing a rolling pin over a perfectly serviceable cake? Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and I just want to let you know that myself and your mother are really proud of you. When I say your mother, I mean your mother in a fictional way, not your literal mother, because I haven't got time to meet all of the mothers of all of the listeners of this show just to keep this opening conceit factual. Anyway, we're really proud of you. In fact, we're so proud that we went into your room last night and we put a specially knitted jumper on you that matched with our specially knitted jumper with a picture of us as a family. We took a selfie of the three of us together and we've posted it through the letterboxes of all of the local houses with a resume of all of your achievements. So proud. And with me is the godfather to my own child to make up for the godlessness of my own parenting, Barry McStay.
Yeah, you picked the lapsed Catholic and homosexual as the godparent.
I couldn't pick a better role model for my child.
I'm very, very excited to go into a podcast about parenting because we've done Worst Wife, haven't we, with Sindhu.
Yep.
So that means next in line is basically Worst Husband because it's the one angle we haven't done on that yet.
Yep. You're just going to try and unload on Mikey.
Please, Ben, it's a family podcast. Yes. Our guest this week is perhaps best known for her 1861 book, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management. Which, oh wait, oh, wrong guest, that's next week. Our guest this week is a former TV executive at MTV and Carlton and senior vice president at Viacom, responsible for shows like SpongeBob SquarePants and South Park. She had cracked the comedy world by making a living off it without any of the hassle of having to go through the meat grinder of actually writing it. But then she took the bizarre decision in 2015 to begin performing as a stand-up. What were you thinking? Thank God she did, though, because since then she's ripped through the circuit with multiple Comedy Award final appearances, bringing her distinctive, hilarious, story-driven act to the masses in the UK and abroad. Her first Edinburgh show, Cat Call, alongside comedy partner Catherine Bohart, received a Malcolm Hardy Award in 2016. And in 2017, she gave us her debut solo show, Super Cali Fragile Lipstick, which is a sellout hit at Edinburgh in 2017, probably just for the name alone. She has appeared several times on BBC Radio 4 and has appeared on the holy grail of panel shows, QI, alongside the legendary Sandy Toksvig, who has described her as properly funny and a real find while fishing her out of the back of the sofa. We're delighted we found her as well. It's Callie Beaton.
Thank you for having me. Oh, that's made me blush. Introduction. Thank you very much. And yes, that show did just sell out on the basis of its name.
I tell you what, a strong pun name is a really good first marker for Edinburgh, generally.
Apart from then you just go downhill. Everyone just looks at your show titles and is like, that's disappointing.
You mean people have come in with too high expectations.
Exactly. I'm going for the show being strong this year. I'm going old school.
So why do you think they do? My first show, the poster was way better than the show.
Yeah, my posters are always going to be better than the shows. I do a good poster.
Do people come see the Super Cali show and were like, oh, this isn't a female Tim Vine?
Yeah, I think exactly. I think people were just, it was nothing but disappointment from the minute they took their coats off.
I think it's a real shame that there isn't an Edinburgh Festival for graphic design.
There's
the poster awards.
Is there a poster award?
Yeah, don't forget to vote now for Ben Vanderveld and Fablemaker on comedy.co.uk.
The worrying thing is, Ben, the poster is really good this year. I'm afraid the show's not going to
Is it? It's definitely either or.
Yeah, I don't think you can do both.
What if you had a good poster, title and show, or is that just never happened?
Because didn't Joe Lycett, Trinity. If Joe Lycett, then he should have put a ring in it, was just a picture of Joe's face. So I think like he really put everything into the title.
He had nothing left, he was exhausted.
So what you're saying, next year I should just turn up with a crayon drawing of a stick figure with some scraggly hair,
drawn by your child?
That would actually be quite good.
Drew it.
If you're doing your I'm a Dad Now show next year, then that's the thing to do.
I refuse to do my I'm a Dad Now show.
Well, you won't call it that, obviously.
I mean, you definitely should call it Ben Vanderveld's I'm a Dad Now Edinburgh show.
Oh, I'm a Dad Now, sorry.
This is the show I don't want to do, but will begrudgingly do anyway. Please come. You're the first, I'm going to get this title wrong, executive vice president that we've ever had.
Senior vice president.
No!
Executive is the word that Donald Trump puts in front of like any gift prize he's giving away to his own fancy.
Here's the thing, having known you for a few years and known what you've done in the comedy world, you're a very hands-on, go-getting person that gets shit done. Whereas senior vice president seems like a ceremonial title.
No, do you know what? That job was, I mean, I won't, it actually was a really full-on job. So yeah, I won't bore you with the hierarchy, but that basically I had a lot of responsibility of people and money in that job.
Right, so it's below Brigadier, but above
Duke.
I'd say definitely above Duke. I don't know where Duke is, but I think I was definitely above Duke. So sadly, it wasn't quite the larking around sort of time. I mean, if you're a non-exec director, now that's when the larking around commences. So that's when you're on a board, but you sort of just drift in and out. Although I think they do now have some fiscal responsibilities, which is why I'm not trying to be one. But it used to be like the sweet spot. So yes. Anyway, that was a hilarious opening gambit, wasn't it?
That's what I always wanted to ask.
That's really good. Why did you suddenly change your mind about it?
This is a very name-droppy story. Yeah, are you ready for me to clunk a name?
Hang on, I'll get down on the floor ready to catch.
Please do. So I got to know quite a lot of on-screen talent through my time, because Viacom owns Comedy Central, among other things. So my favourite bit of that job was that I sat on the Comedy Central development board. So I saw all the cool stuff before it got funded or made. And so we would take sort of on-screen talent to Cannes and to other places around the world just to get investment in shows.
Yeah.
And I got to know the late, great Joan Rivers.
Holy shit, that is a bigger name.
Sorry, my Max Beckett is down here with me. I can't hold it.
it gets worse. So I would introduce her at sort of business events where they would be kind of pissed executives, as in the English definition of piss, not angry but drunk, and they would be waiting, and Joan Rivers would do like a quick bit of stand-up that would be tailored to the kind of event or the place, and then I would be basically trying to get people to invest in her show. And I did a few things with her, and the last time I saw her was about 6 months before she died, and we had dinner together. Sorry, this is very
dangerous. No, this is incredible.
And she said to me, mainly the reason I think she liked me was because her lesbian PA, Jocelyn, really liked me. I think Joan was like, I'll do anything for Jocelyn. So Jocelyn very much kept the Joan show on the road. Anyway, and Joan said to me, you know, Callie, what you're really doing when you intro me is kind of like warm-up. It's like stand-up. Why don't you do stand-up? And I said, Joan, I'm 45, I've got two kids, I've got a massive day job, the ship has sailed. And she said, Callie, I'm 81. You're going to look back at yourself now and know you were in the thick of it and think, why didn't you? And honestly, that was the conversation that changed my life, because you do sort of think that, and I'm sure lots of your listeners are probably younger than that, and you do kind of think that your path is set, or that if you're 45, maybe I'll go and retrain and be an aromatherapist, or I'll sort of downsize. But to do something where you swap kind of status and security, and everyone wants you at their shows, to being literally nobody and having to sort of bang on the doors of the parties where you were on the guest list. I mean, it really is a complete switch, and I found it so refreshing to walk into rooms and no one knew what I did, what I'd done before. I never said it, not least because I didn't want people pitching me their shows for Comedy Central. So for a long time I did both, and it was so refreshing to know that I'm just taken on my own merits, and being a mum, being somebody in the media, just doesn't matter. And I know it sounds weird because people fight for status and recognition. But I really loved, it was like decluttering.
Yeah.
Getting into a world where that didn't matter. So, amazing. Yeah, getting paid in beer tokens instead of corporate shares. Such a smart move.
I mean, I love
it. Sorry, that was the best origin story for a comic I've heard so far.
Really is. When you said name drop, I thought you were going to say someone that, like, is super famous and talented, but, you know, that I'd gig with a couple of times, and I'm like, that's impressive, but I know what they're like.
You were thinking of John Bishop name.
Yeah, right, but yeah. That is biblical level name amazing. Drawing.
Yeah. In my head, my brain has gone, I've watched Joan Rivers interview Kenneth Williams. I've seen Joan Rivers apply powder puffs to Miss Piggy.
Now that's a good one.
Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, if Miss Piggy is the one who's told you to do stand-up comedy.
Like, you're 2 degrees away from Miss Piggy.
Yeah, see, and that is awesome.
We found out the many things that you're good at, but what are your worst at in the world?
Okay, so three things. Well, there's more than three things. Three really obvious things, I think. So, cooking.
Oh.
Really bad at cooking. Relationships. a few other things. Ping pong.
That's a left turn.
I know that's a left turn, but that actually feels... That's quite a difficult one in terms of socially... You do end up in environments where everyone who's sort of any... You know, where you just kind of batten a... Whatever you do, ping pong ball about. I'm properly like can't do it to the point I get quite grumpy if I have to do it.
Did you go to a school where there was like a ping pong table?
I went to an all boys school, which had many an impact on me. And yes, there was, I hadn't thought about that. There was there was a table tennis table, and I just used to play the piano all the time at that school, so no one could talk to me. So possibly that's. But no, I'm just properly. I'm not dyspraxic, but if you give me a ping pong bat. You would think I was dyspraxic.
It's just hard. Ping pong's hard.
Well, it's not everyone. My kids do not make it look hard. I'm sure your kid, Ben, would make it look less hard than I do, and he's one.
Table tennis is the one sport that I can be cockily good at.
Not meant to call it ping pong? Is it meant to be called table tennis?
Yeah, that was fingernails down the blackboard of my soul as you did that.
Did you, sorry, you're going to really hate my name dropping. You know Susan Sarandon has a ping pong, table tennis club in New York.
Table tennis club?
She does. I think it might be called Spin. If I was prepared for this podcast, I would know. Yeah, she does. I know how bad I am because I've been to that club. And it's such a, you have cocktails, you play table tennis. And in my case, you just have to go for the cocktails and sort of not play too much table tennis. I think it is called Spin.
Amazing.
I'd watch Drunk Table Tennis.
Yeah.
As a celebrity table tennis.
Yes, as a follow-up to Drunk
That's
History.
Good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, we're back you in pitching
have,
mode now.
You can have that one. I took whatever other thing was we were talking about before we started.
Between the two of you, take it to Carth and see what they do.
Yeah. Yeah, we're on. We're in, we're on.
You are never going on a British holiday in the 80s.
We are never going to Butlins. Yeah. Ben, no matter how much he asks.
I looked at the word parenting. Apparently, the English verb to parent wasn't used until the 1660s, and it wasn't used as a it wasn't cited in the Oxford English Dictionary until the early 1900s. And you saying parenting didn't overtake child rearing until 1975 in terms of written use.
Really? So you were rearing kids,
you were child rearing
like,
up until
like
that
sort of
point,
pigs on a farm. Which I think is actually, I don't know, what do you think, a year in, is that more appropriate?
Watching the way that my son takes his bottle, where if you just slightly move it away from him, he will chase after the teat, reminds me of a piglet.
Yes, I think chasing after the teat is a thing that it starts young and continues.
So subsides for a couple of years, comes back.
That could be your next Edinburgh show, Chasing After the Teat. No, okay, that's a bridge too far.
I want to see the poster for it though.
I mean, I look forward to the photo shoot.
Yeah.
So child rearing.
Yeah, so you reared your children.
Child herding.
Yeah.
That's good.
Oh, I'd watch one man and his dog trying to herd babies.
Come on, in the pen.
That's another fun.
Drunk one man and his dog.
Drunk celebrity one man and his dog.
Hold on, who's drunk there? Is it the shepherd or the dog or both of them?
The shepherd is drunk, the dog's the celebrity.
That's very good.
Yeah, I like that. I read about some like parenting help books.
Mm-hmm. Like Dr. Spock.
Well, yeah, I might come to Dr. Spock, yeah. I read about some earlier ones, some of his predecessors. In 1693, he had John Locke publishing Some Thoughts Concerning Education. He talked about how
parents should raise virtuous kids and not reward them with candy and toys and things. And but he did write you shouldn't use corporal punishment. That was quite progressive for him for the time.
It's extremely really forward thinking.
On the other hand, you had Rousseau, who said that humans are born innately good, and that actually civilization and socialization degenerates them. And so actually, whatever you do as a parent, you're kind of doomed to actually fuck them up. A bit more of a Philip Larkin sort of outlook on parenting. Yeah. I have some quotes from books that give advice on parenting. This from an 1804 book called Advice to Mothers. In all cases of dwarfishness or deformity, 99 out of 100 are owing to the folly, misconduct or neglect of the mother.
That's nice. And that's fair. I think we could all agree with that to this day. Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
If your child comes out looking ugly, it's probably the mum's fault.
Yeah, always. Yeah, definitely. Always.
That, unsurprisingly, was written by a man, William Buchan. from 1894, a book called The Care and Feeding of Children, Dr. L. Emmett Holt told mothers they should schedule their children's bowel movements.
Yeah, how would one do that?
I don't know. You get a cork.
Yeah.
Two a day, apparently, is what he said. Never kiss them and ignore their crying, which seems to be a common theme.
The ignoring the crying is one that's come and gone, even up until quite recent years. That's a whole other controlled crying debate.
Lots of stuff, I think very sort of British Victorian stuff about a father should never hug their child, just give them a firm handshake.
Yeah, shake. The only time you should kiss them is sort of once on the forehead before bed and things like that.
Yeah, oh, can you imagine? Have you ever shaken your son by the hand, Ben?
Only in jest.
Yes.
I've kissed him much more than I've shaken his hand.
I'm relieved to hear that.
Have you tried to eat his face? Because I think that seems like the default.
No, face, no, but...
Neck and ears and all.
Yeah, I'm more of a calf man.
Ah, yeah, when they have those sort of chunky calves.
When they haven't stretched enough that they just sort of got the bunched skin. Yeah.
Yeah, calves and a nice forearm.
Yeah.
It's very edible. It's a little chew toy.
They sort of are at that age, aren't they?
Although I've also noticed, so what my favourite thing to do with him is to kind of stick him on the front of my shoulders and then swing him down between my legs and back up, and he loves it and is basically working as a kettlebell.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? If I try and do that with my son now, it really is. Yeah. That's quite the workout.
Yeah. There must be a baby yoga classes out there.
There's one, right? You know that you are one street away from the active birth centre.
Yeah.
And I went into labour with my second child in the active birth centre, which isn't quite as it's not meant to be that active. but I was having acupuncture to bring on the somewhat delayed birth of my second child. And I went into labour just a street away from you.
Where did they stick the needle?
Well, exactly. Don't ask. wherever they stick acupuncture needles anyway, so all in the usual places. But it definitely works. It's made me believe.
Led you to pop.
It led me to. I did manage to get down the hill to where I live, which is about 5 minutes from here. But yes, so there you are.
Sweet. So talking of birthing, so we live a 10-minute walk from Whittington Hospital where my son was born, and because my wife is a hard-nosed Caledonian warrior, when the contraction started and it got time to go to the hospital,
she walked
and it's uphill.
Yeah, it's really uphill, and she had every sort of 50 metres she had to stop and
for a contraction fair dues.
I felt like the worst, cheapest husband. As people were passing by, I was like, I couldn't say to them, I wanted to pay for a taxi.
I don't believe it either.
Did she just decide, because you live on a one-way street, it would just take too long to actually drive the one-way system?
Yep.
And at least if people were stopping to gawp, they were coming from the same direction as you. So good on her. Wow.
The crying thing, 1916 book, The Mother and Her Child. Handle the baby as little as possible. Mm-hmm. Turn it occasionally from side to side. Feed it, change it, keep it warm. Oh, I love the
Sounds like a shortbread, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then let it alone to prove, presumably. Yeah. Crying is absolutely essential to the development of good, strong lungs. A baby should cry vigorously several times a day, apparently.
Well, they kind of do. That's a given.
Yeah. I also like this one, which is very precise in its recommendations. At the age of 2 weeks, the child may be systematically carried about in the arms 2 to 3 times a day as a means of furnishing additional change in position, according to Dr. J.P. Crozer Griffith in 1900.
These men knew so much about babies. They were great.
Oh, hang on, it's 4 o'clock, time to move the baby.
And judge dust behind it. Yeah.
Put the papers that it was holding down back underneath it. And I really like this one. In 1878, in The Physical Life of Woman, Dr. George H. Nafees wrote, He cited a published study by an expert called Dr. Henry Kennedy, which suggested that the baby should always be sleeping with its head pointed due north. Because, as he said, there are known to be great electrical currents always coursing in one direction around the globe. In the opinion of Dr. Kennedy, there is no doubt that our nervous systems are in some mysterious way connected with this universal agent, as it may be called, electricity.
I feel like that's almost an early feng shui sort of thing. Don't you feel? I feel like that's almost ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But on, like, I've seen how messy babies can be. They are sort of naturally anti-feng shui beasts.
And do they lie in... They don't really lie that still, do they?
Well, you could put their... Well, I'm presuming these days they were lying in a straitjacket.
Yes, in a brace.
In a metal brace. So, yeah, I think nowadays it would be harder to regulate. Yeah.
Oh, can you imagine the 19th century explorers going out with their baby on a compass?
Yeah.
Trekking through to the along the Zambezi.
It could be the last test for the Boy Scouts. Final badge. Can you get the baby pointing at... Don't worry about orienteering in the New Forest. It's all about the baby's direction.
Another bit of advice. That pregnant mothers should avoid thinking of ugly people or those marked by any deformity or disease.
Pregnant others or mothers?
Pregnant mothers.
Oh, mothers, yeah.
Because apparently if you think of ugly people, your child will come out ugly, which when I read that, it reminded me of an old wives' tale I've heard, which is quite prevalent around the world, actually, that apparently if you have a food craving and you don't fulfill that craving and you scratch yourself as a mother, your child will be born with a birthmark in the shape of that food.
Wow.
On the spot on their body.
Never heard that before.
Apparently it's very common in Israel, Italy, Egypt, Brazil, I think in Australia as well, that they're this person, I read this article and they said mothers in all these different countries came out
really
with the same thing.
Really believe that?
Yeah.
I would just be inclined to think of the most complicated shaped thing. You're thinking that too, aren't you?
I'm trying to think what is the most complicated shaped food
or even
you could
just
eat.
Like a gingerbread man, just to see, because that would be kind of cool.
Yeah,
wouldn't
I was like,
it?
Oh, I really want some lobster thermidor.
Oh, if you got a gingerbread man, then scratch that gingerbread man so it had like another tinier person on it. It just had like decreasing size
like
of people
on them. Like the Matrix Reloaded, Gingerbread Man.
You mentioned Dr. Spock, Dr. Benjamin Spock. In 1946, he published the Common Sense Book of Baby and Childcare, actually co-researched and written with his wife, Jane Cheney Spock. But obviously his name was the one that appeared on the cover. It immediately sold about a million copies. And it's the second best-selling non-fiction book for over 52 years, according to this article I read. It lists the Bible ahead of it, which in the section of non-fiction, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
That's
the Bible outsold
it. Is this
I really wanted it to be the most best-selling one to be The Joy of Sex.
Yes.
You know, like The Joy of Sex, and what to do after this.
He helped, obviously he published it around the time the baby boom kicked off. He recommended a much more positive, balanced approach to parenting. He said, "Trust yourself, you know more than you think you do," was the sort of his encouragement.
Oh, that's really good advice.
I've actually got that book. My grandmother bequeathed that book to me, so because my parents were born in the 40s, so I actually have an original copy of that book, which I could have brought along as a conversation point had I used my brain.
It was very progressive. I mean,
it wasn't that
it's
progressive.
For its time,
there were some quite unsound things.
There was one very serious thing. I think he suggested that you should
keep them outside.
Did he say keep them outside?
Yeah, you had to put them outside for a certain amount of time a day, which I can only assume was in the years before moped thieves.
Clamp your baby to the nearest lamppost.
So, you were meant to keep them outside for like a certain amount of, not all the time, and not facing due north. But you were supposed to give them a sort of airing every day, even in quite harsh.
Do you reckon that's why the North Pole is uninhabited as well? Because whatever direction you're facing south. So you can't have babies there. I think he also recommended you shouldn't let children sleep on their backs, which because they'll swallow their own vomit, which is some people now say actually that's a leading cause of sudden infant death.
Do you know that has gone both ways? So that's literally between my two children, one of them had to be on their back and the other one had to be on their front, and it changed in those years. And I thought, great. So I was really consistently keeping this one the right way up, only for the other one to need to be the other way up.
Well,
and
you're
then
the perfect test group there.
Yeah, so then I knew that at least one child I had been neglecting. But I didn't know which one. What's the thing now?
He's on his back now.
They have to be on their backs.
Yeah. Particularly when he was really little, he was... sleeping pose was just knocked out by Mike Tyson. Both fists above the head.
Oh, that's cute.
But now he's got the stage where he can move in his sleep, so you put him at one end of the cot, and sometimes he will... Have you ever owned hamsters and the hamsters have got those hamster tubes that they're in? And sometimes they'll fall asleep like halfway up the tube in what looks like the most uncomfortable position. So we've gone into his room at night and found him like... like, we sure we put you in this cot lengthways, but you're now in it widthways, and you're too big to be in it widthways.
He sounds very advanced.
That's so good.
Yeah,
yeah. He's very advanced.
Yeah, he is very, very. I think I put it down to the godfather.
Godparents, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Spock, by the way, I nearly called him James Spock. Benjamin Spock.
James T. Spock.
James T. Spock, yeah.
He was really great in Star Wars.
Yeah, really
good.
Really
interesting guy. In 1924... he won a gold medal at the Paris Olympics.
Now that I didn't know.
He was a member of the men's 8 rowing team, which was apparently drawn completely from Yale University. Their rowing team was so good they actually sent it to the Olympics.
And did the cocks have a little compass with a baby in it? Yeah. They knew they were the right
presumably. The team was captained by James Rockefeller, who was later the president of Citigroup, the banking corporation as well. Amazing. And it was in Paris, so they competed along the Seine as well. And later on, in the 70s, he was a big opponent of the Vietnam War. He's very progressive. In 1970, he was apparently tapped up to run to be vice president to Martin Luther King if King had run for president.
He sounds awesome.
And in 1972, he was the People's Party candidate for president on a platform that called for free medical care, the repeal of victimless crime laws, including the legalization of abortion and homosexuality and cannabis, a guaranteed minimum income 45 years before we're now banging on about it again, and for an end to American military interventionism and the withdrawal of American troops from foreign countries. But I have gone for, to find my worst parents, I've gone to the animal kingdom.
Okay.
And
you know my son's a zookeeper, so I may pick you up on anything. Yes,
oh,
yes.
Oh, God,
yes.
I have to be
I'm
very
pretty
careful
good on
what I
this
say.
Stuff.
First of all, I found some adorable videos and pictures of the wrong animal parenting baby animals.
Oh, yeah, that's very
always
sweet.
Great. The
You're
world
a busy
needs...
guy, aren't you?
Oh. my internet browsing history is a really weird mix of rowing in the 1920s and wild boars carrying macaques.
I don't think you're going to get divorced for either of those, yeah. So that's, you're on safe territory. Was that actually a wild boar carrying
macaque? Yeah, in Japan, in a zoo in Japan is a wild boar who carried macaque around. There are instances of dogs adopting monkeys. Guys, if you want to just cheer yourself up, watch a minute-long video of a monkey clinging to the underside of a Pomeranian and just...
Is it a monkey or an ape?
It's a little monkey.
Okay.
It's one of the really cute little ones that sort of very scrambles across the board
and
his tail up. It looks like it could
Might be.
Yeah,
a golden lion tamarin.
It doesn't have the mane, but he's like one of those very skinny little ones. He just And Pomeranians have good long hair for it to grip onto as well. Dogs have adopted squirrels. This is in a safari park in Kansas, a golden retriever was used to raise white tiger cubs. Because their mum had rejected them, and golden retrievers are quite maternal and sort of mm-hmm. very good. And so there's like footage of them suckling at the golden retriever's teats.
I think if Siegfried and Roy had managed to get in the services of it, that would have been a much better
might
way.
Might have saved the day.
But yeah, might have saved the tigers.
And there's an amazing video of an orangutan nursing tiger cubs. So this is in a reserve in Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. Suria, who's a male orangutan, observed his keepers feeding and playing with young tigers, and he thought, I want to have a bit of that. So there's this amazing video of him like picking up young tiger cubs and putting them on his head and sort of tickling them and wrestling with them and feeding them from a bottle.
Oh,
this massive orangutan holding it like a human. It's the most that's the thing that makes you go, we're so close to being apes.
Yeah,
it's
well,
so
we are
ridiculous.
Very close to being apes.
It's so good. And then I read about interesting parenting techniques in the animal kingdom. Sicilians, who are little earthworms, but they're actually amphibians, but they look like earthworms. They live under the soil in rainforests. Their babies feed on fluid that the mother secretes from her cloaca. But she actually feeds it to them by shedding her skin, which is filled with it. So they're essentially biting her skin off, which
That's
grows back on the next few days.
That's a real maternal sacrifice, isn't
it? Really
it
really is.
Have some of my skin.
Yeah.
I feel like that metaphorically a lot of the time.
Yeah,
I
imagine that's very giving you everything.
Exactly.
Strawberry poison dart frogs, they work together to raise their children. They lay their eggs on the rainforest floor, and then the father frog urinates on them to keep them wet and moist and at the right temperature. And then he fights off any predators that come along. And when babies try and eat each other after they and eat the other eggs when they hatch. So when they hatch, the mother frog has to carry them back up into the treetops and deposit them. They've got a little swimming hole in a leaf or something. And she keeps returning to the pond to deposit an unfertilized egg for the baby to eat. while they're growing up. So she feeds them her unfertilized eggs. And so that's... I sort of wonder, why are you laying the eggs on the forest floor then? If you just want them to be up in the tree eventually anyway.
Maybe evolution just hasn't quite worked that bit out.
Yeah, I haven't figured that bit out.
And also they're very bright, the poison dart frogs, which I've always also... My son works in the rainforest canopy at London Zoo, among other things.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, and I'm always asking him about things like that. And he has got answers, but by then usually I'm sort of like, where's the cappuccino?
I really like the dedication of the giant Pacific octopus. The female lays her eggs. It could be hundreds of thousands of them. And they do this once in their life. They mate and hatch once. And they keeps watch over these eggs, fanning the water with her tentacles to keep them clean and oxygenated for about 6 months or more. There's one person, a submarine, passed this one octopus doing it for over 4 years.
That's a workout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's basically, I'm just about imagining like an octopus ceiling fan going round and round. And she does it to keep them alive, and she doesn't eat or rest. So she's atrophying while the eggs are hatching. And then eventually once the eggs hatch, the mother octopus dies.
Oh my gosh,
yeah.
That's incredible parenting.
Isn't it? It's amazing.
Also, I wonder what that octopus must think about the submarine passing it all the time.
Yeah.
Why are the Russians spying on me?
Look, stop checking me out.
That's a very sad... I preferred the macaque on the wild boar.
Yeah,
that's quite a sad one.
We're getting sadder. We're getting into
bad
parenting
now. Is it getting quite dark now?
Harp seals. The mothers are very protective of them for the first 12 days, and then after that they fuck off
and leave them.
And
loads of them, and that's the way natural selection means there aren't too many.
Yeah. House sparrows, if they find out that their partner has mated with another house sparrow, they will go and chuck the eggs out or the chicks out of that other nest so that their husband or their mate raises her kids and not the ones that
I feel like this is the Jeremy Kyle of the ornithological world.
Pandas often have twins, but they only really care for one of them because the nutrients in bamboo is so low that they actually end up only being able to produce enough milk to support one of them. That's why it's so difficult to raise a panda.
We've all got a favourite.
Exactly.
Fair dues. Fair dues.
And the black bear... they'll often have two or three cubs, but if they only have one cub, then the mother will abandon it, deciding that raising one baby isn't really worth all the effort, so she'll just leave.
Good job we don't feel like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know yet, we'll see.
But for my world's worst parents, I've gone for the skink. Yeah.
The blue-tongued skink?
I've gone for the long-tailed skink in Orchid Island in Taiwan, and I will tell you for why. For people at home who don't know, the skink's a type of lizard. And I read this study from 2008 by a guy called Wen San Huang, and he observed filial cannibalism, the process of eating one's own offspring. He says, relatively common in some animal species, particularly in fish, but it's not so common in land-based animals. But in on this long-tailed skink in Orchid Island in Taiwan, when they encountered intruders against which they could defend themselves, often snakes, the females will either attack them or ignore them. But if the intruders kept coming back and the frequency got higher and higher, they would eventually just eat all of their own eggs.
Wow.
To basically just stop the predator coming back and trying to eat the eggs themselves. They've decided that evolutionarily it's more useful for the skink to feed herself than let some other animal and predator.
Well, that does make sense, actually, even though makes me a bit squeamish.
Yes.
for reasons we don't need to explain. But it sort of does make more sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In a sort of shit or bust situation.
In a weird evolutionary way it does. But I can't help but transplant that to parenting and think, oh, the house keeps being, you know, robbed. We may as well just kill the children.
Yeah.
Because eventually they'll try and steal the kids. And
I think if my children were eggs, which skink has, then it would be easier. Because they don't eat the children, do they?
When they're still in eggs.
Yeah, so, you know.
Everyone likes an egg, don't they?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, if the option was kill and eat my son as he is now, probably not. Although, oh, those calves.
I'm going to start with the Hollywood school cheats, just because when you talked about...
Oh, yes, this recent story.
Yeah, and that the Ivy League cheats, you know, people who bought Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy among the people who bought places. So they basically...
Don't tell me William H. Macy is
a
bad guy.
This is the problem.
And Felicity Huffman.
This is the problem, is what happened was, I can't believe you'll see why this becomes... So basically, you're 3 years off trying to get your kid into the right school. So we all know in this country, people will either move house to get near to the school in the catchment area, or they'll go to church for however long. Like,
not
before
happening
they're...
for this, yes. Jew.
So there are lots of people sort of manipulate the system, and it's a real kind of hotbed of, I mean, you know, people get incredibly worked up about this subject. But they took it to a whole new level. This was a few months ago. And so various celebrities were employing this tutor who would then get people to... It wasn't tutoring the kids so they would pass the exams to the best unis. It was paying an enormous amount of money to this tutor who would then get people to sit in as sort of surrogates in the exams. So it wasn't even that they'd been coached through privilege. And then the most amazing one is all, and actually you might, while I'm saying it, be able to pull up a picture of it, but they were photoshopping their kids' heads onto bodies of other athletes to get the athlete places. And then they would get
the scholarships and things.
The scholarships for sport. And then they would get into, and then they would never even join the water polo team or whatever it was. And obviously the colleges must have been in on it. Otherwise, the water polo coach would have been saying, "But I've never seen, your Master Hoffman at a." Yeah. You know. So it was the kind of absolute uber level of cheating, and it was all. And they were paying, you know, millions of dollars for these places. And of course, the really sad thing. So when you think of old Dr. Spock being at Yale on the back of a rowing scholarship, then you think about what would... So the problem with this is, obviously, the people who genuinely are the great sports people who would love to get into those colleges and have no other way in are thereby
getting
pushed out of the place. So that was... I thought that was pretty poor.
That's a really good shout. And also because it's not harmful parenting to the kids, it's harmful to the rest of society.
And actually, what does it say? And to the kids, because if you think about when my kids were young, my kids are now 22 and 19, and when they were little, everyone talked about the snowplow parenting, and you're going along the road, clearing everything out of their path. And then it went into helicopter parenting, so you weren't even letting them on the path, and you were sort of sorting everything out from above. And I do think, I notice this now, the age mine are, that if, you know, it's really tempting to give them all the stuff we didn't have and to make life, it's much easier to make life easy for your kid than it is to make your kid struggle. But if at this level you're basically saying, you know, I mean, I know we've got the whole Jared Kushner thing sort of to remind us of what happens when they, but actually... What are we doing then? Are just assuming these kids can stay in their ivory towers forever, which unfortunately...
They cannot.
Some of them can, though, can't they? If you look at him and you look at the Trump kids, which, by the way...
We could put some bars on ivory towers.
I know. Well, that's true. But that one I think is fundamentally got much broader social implications. And the fact that people who we admire, like William H. Macy, would do that, makes you realise once you're in that world of privilege and money and power and fame... Clearly, at the point at which you want your kid to have something, you're like, I will do anything for my kid to have this. I think tutoring is also, I've got reasonably strong feelings about that as well, because lots of people send their kids to state schools. I was a trustee and a governor at some of the local schools, put my kids through the state system, big supporter of it. But I will admit that my son, who does have, you know, special needs, so he had some issues around learning difficulties, but I did pay for him to be tutored over his GCSE years, and I don't think he'd have got his GCSEs without it.
Yeah.
So I stand up there and say, oh, my kids were state educated, good for me. But I was able to fund something that bolstered that, whereas lots of people can't. So again, that's a minor version of this, I suppose. Yes.
I think it's different. You're not doing anything naughty there. I'm saying there's someone who tutored for 5 years as well. And I saw everything from a family that had clearly scrimped together enough money to afford a tutor.
But you still took it. You were like, I know.
But I did hurt all the way up to, like, the sons of Russian oligarchs, who actually, bless them, they bought me in as an insurance policy because he was incredibly hardworking and diligent and smart anyway, so we just hung out and chatted shit.
That's a good gig.
That's a great gig. Yeah.
Is he the one that reviewed the podcast on iTunes?
Yeah, shout out to Fedor. Thanks, pal.
Excellent. Yeah, I do. I mean, I guess it's just being aware.
By the way, Fedor, I know your dad might not be a Russian oligarch.
He is now. It's very easy, isn't it? Particularly parenting, because as soon as we become a parent, we do secretly think, that our kid is obviously the best looking baby. So you're going to see the babies from like your NCT group or whatever, whoever you knew when you were pregnant.
Revolting trolls, the lot of them.
Always think mine is the good looking one, which everyone's thinking. So obviously not everyone's right. And you always think, well, secretly, well, if I had your child, I could make it eat that avocado or sleep better. But I suppose we do also need to look at, so these bigger things, like what are we at a more micro level doing with our children, and how might it be connected to those much bigger scandals? Because it's very easy, isn't it, to sort of think, well, that's a million miles away from what I would do. But actually, you know, I mean, I do, one of the things I would put in bad parenting categories is anyone who I know where all the children have managed to do amazing things, like all get into Oxbridge, and I'm like, look, I've got one who's drunk and the other one who's failed his A-level. I don't want to hear about proper parenting. So anyway, I thought that was just a phenomenal, it's just like the world we live in, that's even possible. And yeah, how do people even know who this guy is, and how has he got a business?
Yeah.
And by the way, they've all been fined, and I think there's even a talk of custodial sentences. But the guy running the scam, I don't think much.
I've heard anything about him.
Yeah, anything's happening to him. It's like, well, hold on, he's quite pivotal in this.
Yeah, he is. I mean, good hustle.
Really good hustle. And you know, you were missing a trick. You were just helping kids get cleverer. What you should have been doing is photoshopping their heads onto Mo Farah's body.
I started by looking at terrible traditions around the world to welcome children to the world. So in remote villages of the eastern Indian provinces of Maharashtra and Karnataka, there is a 700-year-old superstition. Do you know what this is?
Is this the dropping them off a tower thing?
Yep. There are babies under two, some less than 2 months old, that are dropped from the minarets of mosques and from the balconies of Hindu temples. Some of them are dropped from heights upwards of 50 feet and then caught by men who break their fall with a blanket. But it is...
Who throws them? I'm more worried about the thrower than the catcher. Yeah.
Oh, wait, you're imagining them throwing them? Because I was just thinking dropping, but Callie has like an American football style.
Yeah. It's like an Indian quarterback.
Listen,
yeah.
I want to get into Harvard on the back of my throat.
Yeah, if you can get a bit of spin on an infant. Yeah. It is illegal under Indian law, and it doesn't happen very often, but it is there.
That's great.
In Egypt, 7 days after a baby is born, there's a gathering called the Sabu, which is like a post-birth baby shower. And there's all sorts of lovely things there, and incest is lit, and different food is given.
Incest is lit. I'm just checking.
Yeah.
Incense is lit, and special food is given and stuff like that. But part of it... there's a tradition of scaring the baby with loud noises to teach it courage. Tiny little 7-day-old baby, and they're like bang pestles and mortars next to its ear. The even more creepy one is that at some ceremonies, the baby is placed on a sieve with a knife on their chest to keep away evil spirits.
What?
And if it survives that, it'll survive anything. Mind you might want to share the fact that your son goes around wearing a baking... tray.
Yes. Yeah.
So in terms of the kitchen utensil tradition, it's raging loudly in this household.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be wearing a colander on his head before he's three. Yeah.
Yes, and if he doesn't, he's out of here.
Yeah. In Spain, there is the Castrillo de Murcia, which is where children are laid down on a nice mattress, and a man playing, basically dressed as the devil, runs up and jumps over the hordes of infants, and it's believed that the devil soaks in the sin babies were born with and takes it with him.
It's sort of like an Evel Knievel style.
Yeah, it is. So, but hopefully not misstepping onto the. So I guess there must be a lot of kind of parental competition about whose baby is the last one in the lineup.
You've got yours
near the takeoff point, haven't you?
Yeah. And you want to make sure you're lying them side on rather than lengthways.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Hang on, is he jumping north to south or east to west?
Depends what the baby's telling him, does it?
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like a 6-foot jump. We can all jump like 4, 5, 6 feet, but it's like the minute that you know that I might end up...
Killing a child.
Suddenly, it's like if I could step over a 1-foot gap, but if that 1-foot gap had an 800-foot drop underneath it, then suddenly it's a bit scary.
I think I'd get worse at that. One of the other things I could have said I'm worse at is long jumps. That I would be, and the more the pressure, the worse I used to get.
More impressive if you did it as a triple jump, where you had, if a lot of babies turn up to one ritual and you want to, like, save time.
Yeah.
And you line them up.
Yeah.
My favourite tradition from around the world is in Bulgaria. where it's believed that if a child is praised, the devil will become jealous. So in order to protect it, adults pretend to spit on babies and say things like, may the chickens shit on you.
The opposite of pedestal parenting.
Correct.
Yes, but I like it.
Do you like swearing at your child while you still can, don't you?
I don't swear at him, I swear around him.
Yeah, until you know you're not really allowed
much.
To.
Yeah.
No, I will swear about
in
him.
Orbit.
Yeah, in orbit around him.
Right.
I occasionally call him daddy's little fuckwit. But
aww,
that's all.
Never his swearing sounded cuter than that.
This also takes place in Greece, Romania, and India as a way of warding off the evil eye. In Vietnam, there's a superstition that if you call a baby cute, it'll actually make the baby turn ugly.
Treat them mean, keep them keen.
Yeah, and in China and Thailand, there's a belief that ghosts will steal sweet-looking babies. So particularly in Thailand, they'll keep calling the baby ugly to try and ward off the ghosts.
Come see only the sweet-looking babies. Like, sweet as in delicious-looking babies.
I think it was a bunch of therapists who came up with that one. They were like, always call them ugly, and then we will be having all of our cars and house extensions paid
for. That's a really long game they're playing.
Yeah.
But when it comes to bad parents, I think general stuff like that doesn't cut it. It's all about the specificity. So, first of all, Heather Barrington and her husband, Adam. When Heather was about to have a baby, they decamped to Hawaii and they went to a place called the Sirius Institute. According to their website, the Sirius Institute is dedicated to the creation of human-dolphin co-creative habitats where dolphins and people can learn from each other through the music, underwater birth, dolphin sound healing and restoration. That's right, they were going to have a dolphin-birthed baby.
That sounds awesome.
Well,
dolphins get really horny.
Damn right. Dolphins are absolutely horrifying.
You heard it here first. Yeah, suck on that, tourist boards.
According
101 things to do before you die. Give me a porpoise any day.
Yeah, 101 things to do before you die, having been killed by a pod of dolphins. Not only do dolphins kill other animals, they kill baby dolphins using the same brutal tactics. They kill seals. They also go around having non-consensual sex with sharks.
Okay, that is a bridge too far.
Loss is there. Dolphins are like the anti-shark, and now we find out they're sleeping together.
Oh my god.
Twist!
Yeah. Dolphins have actually been designed by M. Night Shyamalan. So according to the Barringtons, they want to spend time in the water forming a bond with the dolphin pod. It is about reconnecting as humans with dolphins so we can coexist in this world together and learn from one another. They believe that children born in the water with dolphins develop 6 months faster over the first 6 months.
Well, you don't want that.
So they're like a year old
by the time they're 6 months. Yeah.
Well, that's all.
And they have perhaps 150 grams more brain weight, and they're ambidextrous because apparently they learn that from the dolphins.
Yeah. Do children come out strong-handed, one way or the other?
I think they do. I think nowadays they do say it's a real strong preference, and
Yeah, I don't know. I've not really paid attention to which hand my child prefers. I know what he mostly prefers is face planting his dinner.
But, and he does that symmetrically?
Yeah.
Straight down the middle.
Excellent.
Straight down the middle. Yeah. He face plants north.
Yeah.
This place, is it institute? First of all, anyone who's bringing they're going to give birth in an institute is definitely worrying straight away.
Although Hawaii,
great, but then institute makes you feel like there's going to be some sort of cloning operation.
Yes.
Is it like a marine reserve or is it like a water park with dolphins in tanks?
That's a good question. I don't know.
You want to know if it's more like that one where,
Well, I'm sort of like, are you like dipping, are you sort of swimming in a little swimming pool or are you like possibly going to be dragged out to sea?
Yeah. But I don't think these parents care.
Yeah.
I think they're not minding either way.
Because as soon as a child pops out, grab the umbilical cord, stop it floating away.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you, if you go to the Sirius Institute's website, it looks like it was made in 2005 and has mostly got a picture of the galaxy in the background.
Oh, wow.
Now, that does not look like
I just saw the words, the whales sing to the stars.
I think it's got a little bit of an aura of sort of Scientology.
New Age,
don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very New Age.
It's very Marianne Williamson.
You can become part of the Cetacean Commonwealth if you join them.
How much does that cost, I wonder?
Yeah. Well, I believe it's where you go to dolphins and you steal all of their natural resources.
Yeah. As long as you don't steal their jokes, then I think it's fine.
So yeah, they were very tempting as a suggestion. I want to very briefly tell you about a gentleman from Japan who had a son called Duo, and he.
How many of them were there?
He was not twins. He was one boy. And he is one of these classic parents. There's loads of quite miserable stories about parents who want to turn their children into ultimate warriors. Like, you know, who basically, like, from the age of very, very young, they put them through their paces doing press-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups and all that. Duo is 4 years old, and his father is called Haley Shing. And Haley Shing has, got him doing all his exercise. They climbed 11,000 foot up Japan's Mount Fuji, where they became stranded and had to become rescued by park rangers. This is when the kid is 4 years old.
Wow.
And the kid walked himself, I guess.
Yeah,
don't imagine he was getting a piggyback.
I wonder what the park ranger's upbringing was like, though, to be able to go and save them. Maybe the park ranger was park ranger.
His dad had walked him up 11,000 foot.
That's a good point.
That's
a good point.
That Duo is going to turn grow up to be two park rangers when he's an adult and, you know, save another child.
Oh, so it's
so called Quattro, and it's just going to keep continuing.
It's like the Russian
that.
Dolls of upbringing of children.
Yeah, it's basically a Ponzi scheme.
Wait, hang on a second. This park has some sort of scheme where it encourages dads to walk their children on Mount Fuji, then hires the children when they come back down.
Now that is forward thinking.
But I've got one more thing before my suggestion. This is more bullshit New Age thinking. So there is something called the Indigo Child Movement.
Oh God!
And this is developed.
I hate this already.
My heart is sunk, 'cause you're not.
Yeah.
So this is developed in the 70s, and the gentleman who developed it, Lee Marshall, believed... the gentleman, Lee Marshall, is the Newcastle United press officer.
He does the amps at rock concerts.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
The gentleman who developed it... I've been reading the Newcastle website a lot this week and crying.
Yeah.
The gentleman who developed it is Jan Tober and Lee Carroll, and it's called The Indigo Children, The New Kids Have Arrived, and they believe that from the 1970s onwards... there has been the most exciting, albeit odd, change in basic human nature that has ever been observed and documented because children have been born that have been observed to have an indigo aura, a vibrational colour that has never been seen before. And they believe that it is creating a new consciousness in children. They share traits like high IQ, acute intuition, self-confidence, resistance to authority, and disruptive tendencies, but that means that they are the next level in human evolution. They're basically X-Men.
Well, all the kids who've been born since 1970?
No.
Just the indigo kids.
The indigo children. There are a number of children since the 70s who've been born with an indigo aura.
Replicants.
Yeah. And they may appear to you or me or to the teachers who teach them to be disruptive children with behavioural difficulties, but no.
Do you think my son's an indigo child?
I've not observed his aura yet.
Rather than a pain in the arse, yeah.
It certainly makes you feel a lot better about your parenting if you just go, no, he's indigo.
Yeah. I feel as somebody who was born in 1969, I take great exception to this. I don't feel
as well. You just missed out. If you were born in the 70s.
I would certainly have been an indigo child.
So the next level is violet childs, and then we get ultraviolet children.
Yeah, ultraviolet children you just can't see unless you're on the right wavelength.
Do you think your child is an indigo baby?
No.
No, you can't see him.
Tartan.
Yeah.
Definitely a tartan baby. But my suggestion is a child, who will now be a grown-up, because this is a news report I read from August 1996. And it is a child called Alex Spears, and his father is a gentleman called D'Armond. Not as in the almond, spoken in a bad Irish accent.
from Yorkshire.
Yeah.
D'Armond.
Or D'Armond. In it, the first word that Alex says to his father is Vavoy. And you know where this is going.
Oh,
let's see.
No.
And Vavoy means daddy in the language that his dad is teaching him. And he looks like quite upset. So Alex's father responds by going KB Yisaku, which means I'm just telling him it's all right, you're okay. And it might not seem like a very tender language to say KB Yisaku, and that's because his father is teaching him to speak
Klingon.
Oh, God.
And the worst thing about this is that he's not even much of a Star Trek fan. He's doing it.
He's a big linguistics man, though.
Yeah!
Is that
no!
Why?
Is that's why. It's experiment. Because it's a constructed language and it's a linguistic experiment. Like, you know.
Like the Game of Thrones language.
Yeah.
Because people are Dothraki, learning that now,
yeah.
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is incredible. I listened to Helen Zaltzman's podcast yeah. all yeah. about that, and the guy who constructed it. He basically did the etymology of it. There are 4,000 words yeah. to it. He did the history of yeah. the language. It's incredible.
Is it Dothraki is the language of it?
Dothraki's the one.
I did ADR on a couple of episodes of Game of Thrones, series 3 or 4. And we had to do like background of guy of some of the people murmuring in one scene where they had to speak Dothraki. And basically the instruction we got was, here are two words that you should try and say at some point. The rest of it, just kind of do Russian in an Arabic accent or Arabic in a Russian accent, whichever works for you.
Brilliant. A well-conceived yeah. plan. So basically, yeah, I think anybody who, that should be an overarching, anyone who uses their kid as an experiment. Because yes. imagine your kid, literally, this is going to be a thing I'm going to try with you because it would interest my linguistic curiosity. You'll get the shit beaten out of you at school every week, but I'd like to see how this plays
yeah.
out.
And you teach him English as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because yeah. his mum is so
bilingual.
Lonely. So
Klingon
lonely.
Klingon and English.
Yeah, okay, yeah. good, yeah.
yeah.
I'm taking a degree in yeah. Klingon and English.
He's sort of carrying on a great tradition, like John Stuart Mill, the Victorian philosopher, his dad basically hammered him full of Latin, Greek, Arabic, Hebrew, and a couple of other languages.
That's great for reading lots of ancient texts and things.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Useful.
But did it by the time he was like 7 or 8.
But that's when you've got to get the languages in. You've
yeah.
got to
yes,
get them
right.
in.
That is true.
If you were bringing your kid up bilingually, now would be the most crucial time to be speak pre-verbal.
He's going to speak Geordie like a native.
Amazing.
I mean, to be fair, the best thing about this is that this kid will be able to teach Klingon as a foreign language, which is a
yeah.
very niche yeah. area, but he'll be able to do it.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's setting him
nice
up for his gap year.
Yeah, it's great.
There's a really heartbreaking bit in the news report that I read. Says, from the grocery checkout counter to the folks at the daycare centre, strangers routinely stop and ask Spears what in the hell he's saying to his son. He used to simply answer Klingon, but now he says a constructed language, which usually stalls any further comment.
If you're lying about the language you've taught your kid, there's a sign that maybe you shouldn't have taught the
yeah.
language to your kid, I think. If
yeah.
you can't even stand by
is this
it.
Is 1996, he said?
1999.
So just pre-9/11.
I'd really
because
like...
then people in America hearing someone speaking their
yeah,
language.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. He also sings lullabies to him in a...
Klingon lullaby.
Yeah.
Please, go on and give us a couple of bars.
So, Tashaj wo esh
Tashaj
vodlema. No way can I lullaby this. Or maybe Tachach wo Esh Tachach Vodlechem Awi Tochmo Vachnu Koma Tach Tadon Woma Ech Koch Chokach Vei Vach Desmayach. I feel like I'm back in synagogue.
I was going to say
yeah,
a bit
yeah.
more like
and translated that says, may the empire endure and may our emperor endure. We serve him so that he may honour us.
Wow.
Our empire is wonderful, and if anyone disagrees, we will crush them beneath our boots. Good night, darling. Sleep tight.
Oh, no fluffy sheep in that lullaby.
God, if only Brahms knew 130 years ago. Adapting his lullaby.
But my favourite thing of this, before he puts him to bed, when I ask him to turn out the light, I say the Klingon for make it dark. He also explains that there is no Klingon word for love because they don't have the concept.
Oh,
but in
no.
such situations, he does simply surrender to the English.
Oh.
So, yeah, because I could almost forgive it more if he was a Star Trek fan.
Yeah, that's the bit I don't get.
Yeah.
I don't think, and if you're going to do a linguistic experiment, it'd be more interesting to come up with a sort of a
yeah.
Game of Thrones equivalent and create you could, if he's that interested.
Yeah. Well, go, there'd be no Esperantos there. You could have done that.
Yeah.
No, so he did think about Esperanto, but he decided to use Klingon instead because, in his words...
Because he was a dick.
yeah. But his justification, one of the problems with Esperanto is there's no binding culture behind it.
Right.
Yeah, no culture. So obviously I assume that this child is going to learn all about Klingon culture as well.
The dad doesn't understand it because
no.
he's not a fan.
You're right, this is not consistent parenting.
No,
is what's
it is
happening
not.
Here.
It's inconsistent parenting.
Which ultimately is the worst kind of parenting
and
available.
And it's the parenting we all do. So yeah.
Our suggestions... For the world's worst parents.
It's a real mixed bag, isn't it?
Yeah.
A potpourri.
Yeah. Barry's suggestion of the cannibalistic egg-eating skink Callie's suggestion of William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman creating false identities for their children to get into high-ranking universities, and mine of D'Armond Spears, a man who is a man and not an almond, teaching his child...
He's not an hors d'oeuvre, is he?
Yes.
An amuse-bouche.
Ruining his child's prospects in life from the age of two by teaching him Klingon.
He'll never get a girlfriend. Literally,
no.
Ever.
No.
There's no word for love anyway. You wouldn't know how to start talking. Doesn't matter. Yeah.
I really don't know. I really don't know, because Callie, you argued yours extremely passionately and cogently, and all of us are like crushed at the thought of a parent teaching Klingon, but none of them are consuming their child. But I don't know, because I understand the evolutionary thought behind it. And I understand emotionally what William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman are doing, even if I disagree with it morally. Whereas experimenting on your children with a language is so repugnant. And it's like, the thing is, we're all going to embarrass our children. But I tend to think I'll embarrass my child when he's like 15.
Yeah.
But embarrassing your child when they're 2.
Yeah.
Which do we think is most damaging?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, at least he's learning. I don't know. Being eaten alive. No, nearly alive. That's quite damaging.
Yeah. And you are impartial.
Yeah, I am very impartial. Yeah, yeah, yeah. At least he's learned a new language. Not a very useful one, but a new language nonetheless.
I mean, it's certainly not a level playing field in terms of the examples we've given here. It's quite hard to, isn't it?
Yeah, because anything you or me say, Callie, Barry can just go, yeah, but are they eating their own kids?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he's going to keep saying that.
He is going to keep
saying that. I say that as the one non-parent of the group as well.
Yeah, and at all family reunions for however long, that's what he's going to say.
Yeah, I sort of think the skink has it.
Yes, skink! I knew it. Yaskink.
Yaskink. Yeah. Until William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman think
eat
that consuming one of their children as a health supplement.
Yeah.
Which, and it's only a matter of time before
Hollywood
goes that way.
William Paltrow's already done that with Apple.
Yeah.
Well, that's her fault for naming it Apple in the first place.
Exactly.
Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. And we go to Nevada, where the highway patrol has pulled over a hearse. And the reason that they pulled the hearse over is because it was driving in the carpool lane. Mm-hmm. And apparently, if you've got a corpse in a coffin in your hearse, that doesn't allow you to drive in the carpooling lane.
That's a tough crowd.
That's hard.
Real tough crowd.
Wow. Like,
but if they'd had the grieving wife in there as well, so all you need to do is always have a mourner.
You could have argued that they were alive when he started the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then they're going to call the highway patrol over at police. Before we go, Callie, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
They can find me at Callie Beaton on Instagram and Twitter. And can I do a plug for Edinburgh? Yes,
yeah,
I'd like to do it. I don't know why I'm asking that, because I'm going to do it anyway. So I am doing a show called Invisible in Edinburgh. I'm on at the Assembly George Square at 10 past 5 in the afternoon, every day from the 31st of July to the 26th of August, apart from the 13th of August.
A wise day off.
Yeah, very wise.
Brilliant stuff. We're all off to find out how you say, could I have a skink egg omelette in Klingon, please? Until next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hello, everyone. Ben here. As is tradition, I'm going to offer up my prayers to the podcast gods in the form of asking you to do one of several things which you can do to support the podcast, whether this is your first time listening to us or your 126th. If you want to help us in the easiest and cheapest way, then give us a rating and a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Castbox or whatever podcast listening app that you use. Even after doing the podcast for 2.5 years, this sort of thing really helps make the podcast more visible, which means that more people listen to it, which means that we'll continue making them. Also, if you would like to continue helping us out, then you can donate to us on Patreon from as little as $2 a month. It'll get you wee bits of extra content on Patreon. We release an extra episode purely for people who donate $3 a month, with sometimes we do
like cheeky little specials about something that's happened that month, or we give you never before heard offcuts that were really good but not quite good enough for the episodes, all the way up to, if you pay $20 a month, then you can come and be a guest on the show, which will be happening with a couple of people in September. Last of all, you'll have just heard Callie do a plug for her Edinburgh Fringe show. Well, I am also going to the Edinburgh Festival. I'm going to be there every day from August the 1st to August the 25th, apart from August the 14th, where I'll be doing my brand new show, Fable Maker, at a bar called 32 Below, which is just underneath the Counting House, which is one of the big hub free fringe venues. It's on at 5 past 5, and the show is a 100% improvised hour of stand-up storytelling. So if you like the sound of that, and you've enjoyed what I've done on this podcast, then please do come along. I am aware that quite a few of our listeners live in America and around the world. If you want to commute to Edinburgh, brilliant. If you'd rather not do that, but you know someone who lives in Britain who might go to the Edinburgh Festival, tell them about my show, tell them about this show, and let's get a Worst Foot army coming along to watch me talk stuff and nonsense for an hour. Thanks as ever for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week. I'm not sure. We're recording a couple of comedians this week, Jacob Hawley and Will Duggan, which we may well release so they can have a cheeky plug for their show in the run-up to Edinburgh. Or we might have a masked, muscled gentleman from Nashville, Tennessee. You'll just have to wait and see. Until next week, bye-bye.